Welcome to Love at First Science, the podcast designed to dig deep into neuroscience, the human body, and anatomy. My name is Celeste. I'm a physio and I teach anatomy to yoga teachers. And this podcast is an archive of the lessons I've learned along the way in my attempt to bring a more science-based approach into the yoga world. Hey friends, thanks for tuning in. Just a quick reminder that I don't run any ads, so this podcast can only grow with your support. If you learned something new that you found useful, please do rate and review the podcast. And if you think the content can help someone get out of pain, improve their life, move without injuries, or even just feel more inspired, please share it with them. It would mean the absolute world to me, and you never know, we just might help elevate our community along the way. Probably one of the people I have the most respect for, he's my absolute hero, it's Dr. Eric Cobb. He started Z-Health Performance. I've been studying in their curriculum, and I'm, as always, quoted as saying, it is even better than my university degree. It's better than any other course I've taken, and I highly encourage all of you to please at least do Essentials of Elite Performance, their most basic paid-for course. They also have a free one just before that called Neurofundamentals. At least do that, because it's going to give you this entirely unique perspective on the human body. Anyway, I'm bringing in Dr. Cobb to talk about headaches. I'm actually in one of their membership programs that guides us on how to assist people with headaches, chronic headaches. And we spoke about pain together in a previous episode. Do me a favor and go and listen to that. And then if you are someone who struggles with headaches, migraines, this is the place to be, because Dr. Eric Cobb, he is so smart about helping people. And I just can't get enough of the information he shares. He's a legend. Let's welcome Dr. Eric Cobb. This episode has been broken up into two parts, and this is your part one. So I am honored to again have on Dr. Cobb, who's my hero. I hope you know that. You're my hero. Because don't shake
very your head. Sad.
Well, because I felt like a lost little puppy dog for a long time, A, in my own body, B, I was like, I knew I was interested in biomechanics and the human body, but you know, looking back, I felt a bit lost. And now my body is working, I feel so excited about what I'm learning, and I'm actually having results with my clients, which I think is the most important thing to highlight. Absolutely. So thank you for Z Health.
I'm happy to hear all of that.
I know it hasn't been an easy journey for you bringing Z Health to the masses. So I just want to say thanks for your persistence.
Thank you. Yeah, it's I was thinking about this intensely the other day. It's been a interesting, difficult ride. I mean, we're 20 years this year. And it's pretty fascinating to watch the growth kind of around the world of this concept, this idea that, hey, we should know more about what's happening with the nervous system and blend that with what we know about biomechanics. So it's been very interesting to be kind of a participant and witness as I think things have evolved, but it certainly has been, challenging, just like every field. You have something kind of new, kind of different, and there will be periods of resistance. But ultimately, it either works or doesn't, right? There's some proof in the concept. And so I'm happy to see that at least happening.
Yeah, definitely is working. And one of the things I wanted to bring you on the show today to talk about is headaches, because so many people struggle with that. Before we get into that though, I do have a personal question to ask you, because I teach online yoga classes, and I teach groups in person as well. And I have this desire to blend the brain drills that you guys have taught me that have worked so incredibly well with these groups, but you have kind of drilled into us, and I've seen it myself, that not every drill is going to work for every person. So I'm faced with testing out things, and sometimes people come up to me and be like, oh yeah, your class made me feel like I was going to throw up, and I'm like, oh no, that was all the easy drills.
Right. Yeah.
Any tips for us people who are teaching groups? And I mean, that's a horrible question to start the interview with, but I was like, I have no clue if what I'm doing is actually hurting people, or should I be pushing them? I don't know.
Yeah. So, you know, this is an interesting topic, because it really bumps up against the science of exercise. And this is, I think, something I've been talking about for literally before Z Health. Because as a movement coach, a tennis coach, martial arts instructor, teaching group classes is extremely challenging because I think all of us know that if we have kind of an average client, right, someone who's relatively in shape, they don't have a tremendously bad medical history, et cetera, that we can probably do something fairly general with them and they'll have decent results. But everything that we're seeing in medicine, in movement therapy, et cetera, is pushing further and further into this idea of personalization and individualization. You know, in the cancer world, doing a ton of testing, looking at individual gene sequences to try and figure out how, you know, will this person respond to this medication or this medication? And basically what I generally teach in our courses is group classes are basically there as a screening tool. And what I mean by that is I think it's a fantastic thing to offer. You teach online, you teach group classes, you get people moving. I think the key as an instructor is to be very clear with them in the beginning and throughout that if something doesn't make you feel good, there's a reason for that. And we need to find out what that is, because that may be a key that's giving you pain. It's holding you back from progressing in your practice. So I've always directed kind of the people in our courses to think about group training as a screening tool. If there were, you know, if you've got 20 people, 18 are responding relatively well, and they're sharing that in the process, and two are like, yeah, that made me want to throw up. Well, then we probably need some more individualized assessment for you so that we can personalize this because you have some underlying issues. And I think the hardest thing for teachers in general that do a lot of group class work is they are uncomfortable with that. But it's not your fault.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what I'm, you know, I've seen this over and over in that, like, well, I feel bad that the exercise made you sick. You didn't do that to them. Their nervous system didn't respond well. And again, if you've done some due diligence, you've explained what you're doing, you're explaining to them how to do a little self-assessment, be aware of yourself, be aware of what you're feeling, stop. If you don't feel well, don't continue. If they wind up feeling terrible, again, to some degree, that's on them as long as you've told them what to look for. I have always encouraged group class teachers to teach basic forms of assessment or self-assessment and have people use them throughout a class. Whether that's just a basic movement reassessment, whether that's a balance reassessment, whether that's a body scan, I'm just going to see how I'm check in. I'm going to see how I'm feeling, and help people kind of self-grade. In the strength training world, this is related a little bit to the idea of autoregulatory training, where you're kind of paying attention to, do I feel like I can push hard today or not? So there are multiple iterations of this in multiple fields. And I think we just have to be very upfront with clients. And be okay with the fact that, hey, if we discover something in this class that you're not responding well to, then you need some individualized attention.
Yeah.
And just, you know, leave it at that. You know, if people are in pain, if you didn't run over them with your car, that's not your problem, right? It's not your fault. It's your ethically, what we have to do is explain to them maybe what's going on and say, these are some approaches that we could take. So that's my general take on group classes.
That's extremely helpful already. I mean, one of the challenges that particularly the style of yoga that I've been teaching groups is that we kind of link all the postures, and I was then linking in all the brain drills in there, and people were like, I am not feeling well doing your stuff. And I was like, maybe I'm overdoing it just a bit. Yeah. So I've definitely pulled back. So I've learned so much through the process. I'm almost grateful I've done it, but I was really curious to hear what you said. And I think, do you know, the easiest thing is probably the body scan. I think that's brilliant advice.
Yeah. You know, if you can help people understand that if they're going through a practice that is designed to make them feel better, more relaxed, and they're 20 minutes in and you just did a posture followed by VOR drills and their back's locking up or they're feeling a ton of tension in their feet because they can't balance, that's a problem, right? Mm. So I think as long as it's well explained, because people, if I can say it this way, many people that don't move for a living are somewhat divorced from sensation, right? That's basically how a lot of us get through life. Right? We feel stuff, we ignore it. So we have often trained ourselves to pay very little attention to things that are potentially problematic. So without coaching and without being directed to, hey, are you feeling tension here? many people are unable to even identify that. So, you know, as an example, in some of our advanced classes where we're working on speed development is deeply related to relaxation, even under load. And so when you look into the literature, there's different forms of relaxation training, you know, that have been around for a long time. One of my favorites is autogenic training, which is basically, you know, I want you to pay attention to your right foot. You're going to tense and relax and tense and relax. And it's very interesting, even in a group of professionals, that if I take the group through an autogenic training session, how often people will come up and say, yeah, I was carrying so much tension in my right calf, but until you said, you know, pay attention to your calf, I was unaware of it. So,
and that's someone who moves probably for a living.
Yeah,
can you imagine someone who's sitting in a chair all day?
Right. And so that's where, as I said, I think the clarity that you bring to all the explanations and really telling people what to look for. Because the difference between amateurs and professionals and almost everything is that they have a more clearly refined map of what's important and what's not. So if you're teaching people about movement and teaching people about their body, then you need to be very clear with them on this is important, this is not.
And this is why I'm studying with Sea Health, because I'm trying to figure out what's important and what isn't. Because I was going on and on about all the unimportant things for a hell of a long time. And then I was like, oopsie.
That is the route we all take, sadly.
Well, no, I mean, I just want to say thanks, basically. And the other thing I wanted to say thanks for was you've got this new membership available on Sea Health, which is the BPGP, which is hard to say.
Trust me, even on our team meetings, we're like, you know what, the membership, don't even try.
Yes, the membership. And guys who are listening, basically the reason I wanted to bring Dr. Cobb in is I have a couple of clients that have severe chronic headaches. And as soon as I saw that was one of the first parts of the membership, I was like, oh my gosh, no brainer. So I got the membership, hours and hours of lectures. And then it was funny because I got to the end with the Q&A and I was like, oh, I still know nothing. Because all the questions you were answering, I was like, wow, I wouldn't have been able to understand this even. So it's a huge, vast, vast topic, guys. So I just want to say, quick side note, forgive me if we're not covering your exact issue, but we are going to try our best to give you guys some practical tools of things that can help based off of some of the information that Dr. Cobb has shared there. And obviously, listening to you do the Q&A, you obviously knew so much more and you were just going on about things. I was like, wow, like I have got my work to do. Like, there's a
the membership programs, I have loved them. I think putting them together is incredibly fun and cool because there's so much emerging information, but you know, it's a 5 to 6 hour course as opposed to 5 years of working in a headache clinic. There's a lot of information on headache, and we try to pull out the most important pieces, but you know, then as you start getting deeper into this topic, you have these very rare, unusual presentations that they're certainly harder to find, and in many cases they're harder to address. So
even the foundation that you laid already has helped me move the needle for my clients. Ordinarily I wouldn't have had that opportunity, so it is still great, all the stuff. I guess wanted to preface the fact that this is a massive topic, so now that everybody knows that, let's definitely touch upon what are some of the big misunderstandings around headache. I know in the membership you were talking about, it's kind of ignored. All of us movement people, we're just like, oh, you got a headache, don't come in today. But actually there's a lot we can actually do to help people.
Yeah, this is probably, this is one of my little rants that I always go on about.
Oh, I love a rant.
Different issues. In the movement world, we tend to shy away from, first of all, in the movement world, we shy away from anything from the neck up. Unless it's a specialist who does TMJ work or headaches, et cetera, we just kind of ignore it and go, it'll go away. And when it goes away, come back and we'll do the cool, important stuff called exercise. But the fact is, when you start to dig into not just headache, but almost any presentation, right? Any pain presentation that people might have, there usually is a rehabilitative process available that in most cases has not been explored because it is extremely unusual for any practitioner to have kind of a full scope vision of what could be done, right? Because most of our traditional training methodologies take us in one direction. And I'm going to use a kind of a personal example here. My son is just about to finish his third year of medical school. Prior to going to med school, he spent 2 years in a pediatric clinic, and he spent a full year in a, well, he spent 2 years in, one was in a neurologic rehab clinic, and the other was in a headache clinic. That's all that they did. And the headache clinic that he previously worked in was very cool because the doctor was a neurologist. All he did was headache, and he was very aware of the fact that his tools were somewhat limited. He had injections available and he had medications available. And he recognized that if those were ineffective, and which they're going to be in many cases, because that's just how things work. He also, within that practice, had a physical therapist, a massage therapist, a chiropractor, a vision therapist, and a vestibular therapist. So it was actually a doctor who said there are many reasons that these headaches may be coming. And from a medical perspective, a lot of what we do is symptom control, not rehabilitation. Because when you want to look at a rehabilitative process, it's probably going to involve more than just meds. And I'm saying that to contrast that with, in one of his most recent rotations was a neurology rotation. And, you know, half the people they were seeing in this neurology rotation were migraine sufferers, et cetera. And in that particular practice, the only real options they have made available were medications. And actually most of the medications that were being suggested in many cases were probably 5 to 7 years out of date.
Because, and had side effects.
And because of the, but that was the practice modality that that doctor was using. Mm-hmm. And I'm not here to judge anyone's, I'm not seeing these patients. I can't judge what they were doing, but talking to my son about it, he had this very interesting, like, compare and contrast of, okay, this is kind of a traditional practice. This is more of a forward thinking practice. And again, from the ZL perspective, anytime someone has a condition, whatever that may be, our curiosity is there something that we can do to facilitate that client or that patient or whatever moving beyond this, where it becomes something that they're not managing, but something that they have recovered from. And I think in the movement world, very little attention is given to the idea that you can recover from a headache presentation, depending on what type it is.
Hey, my loves, real quick, if you are hypermobile, be sure to check out my book, Too Flexible to Feel Good, where my co-author and I share the latest science on how to help a bendy body feel awesome. If you already have the book, please do leave it an Amazon review. It helps more than you could ever know, and it just might help someone else feel a bit more stable in their bodies. The book is called Too Flexible to Feel Good, and you can get it from most online retailers.
Oh my goodness. You know, Dan actually had long COVID and he ended up getting this crazy headache. Mm-hmm. And we actually had an online assessment with a neurologist, mm-hmm. and he just gave him pain medication. He saw him for 10 minutes, didn't mm-hmm. ask him anything about, we're going to talk about the classics in a moment.
Yeah.
And then he took the pain meds, it didn't work. And Dan has a slight lazy eye. And I was like, do you know, maybe we could just try a couple of vision drills. He was really resistant to the whole Z-Help thing for a while. I was like, could I please just try and do something for your eye? In the end, no. But I said, you know, why don't we trust dry, put a patch on your strong eye and see if that'll take care of your headache. Anyway,
right.
He was like, of course, disagree. I'm on a call with work. Suddenly he runs down the stairs, almost breaking the stairs down with like my eye mask that I sleep with on his strong eye. And he's like, my headache's gone. I was like, and then from then on, he was a convert.
Yes.
But I was just disappointed that the neurologist didn't ask about A, the classics, which we're going to discuss now, or B, even just at least check his eyes. I was really sad about this.
I would say in medicine in general, the days of the generalist have gone away, you know, where the training obviously is different around the world, different medical university approaches. But in general, you know, I think physicians become more and more specialized. And often, you know, anything that they even consider potentially a problem with the eyes goes to the ophthalmologist. Anything related to the sinuses goes to the ENT. If it's a TMJ problem, again, I'm going to refer to oromaxillofacial surgeon or whatever. So it seems that in many cases, the window of the things that they're willing to evaluate and assess, unless there is a true, from their perspective, diagnostic issue, like, hey, did he have a stroke? Did he, et cetera, that for the most part, it's about management. You have pain, we'll give you some pain meds, hopefully you feel better. Yeah. If you don't, I'll refer you to someone else.
Yeah, it's so sad. And even like I have another client who's really suffering with headaches and I said to her, oh, have you had your eyes assessed? Yes, I went to the eye doctor. Oh, what did they do? Oh, they just put stuff in my eye to dilate my pupils and they just asked me about acuity. And I was like, so they didn't check like convergence or divergence, they didn't check tracking. And in the end, we discovered her eyes don't actually like moving to the left. Whenever she does that, her threat goes up. I'm digressing. Let's get to the classics. Because I can just rant about the way things are for a long time. You mentioned in the course about how important it is to kind of assess diet and sleep and water intake. And certain foods can obviously be triggers. Of course, sleep is so such a huge thing, but I was fascinated to learn that actually some people could be drinking too much as well as too little water.
Yeah,
that was fascinating for me. I was always told it's dehydration, got to drink loads of water.
Everything's about dehydration. Yeah, this is kind of funny. I won't call it a pet topic, but I find it interesting. When you really look for the research on how much water we're supposed to drink, there isn't any. Like there's no actual hard data. I think most people have heard the, you know, you need whatever,
2 liters
a day.
Yeah.
In the US, they would talk about you need eight ounce glasses per day or something. And some people actually went and looked where did that come from? And it was actually the idea originated in a Japanese marketing campaign for a water company. So in general, what you'll see, you know, most research scientists now talking about hydration, they're like, if you're thirsty, drink. If you're not thirsty, don't force yourself.
Okay.
Because what can happen with excess water intake is it can create electrolyte imbalances. Now, obviously, I think almost everyone has heard of the idea of water intoxication, that you can actually drink enough water to kill you because it can make your electrolyte balance so poor that it can induce basically heart issues. So I'm always curious when I'm working with someone with headaches. It's one of the first questions I'll ask them, like, do you drink water? And they'll almost always be like, I probably should be drinking more. And I'm like, no, that's not why I'm asking. I actually want to know, you know, are you forcing yourself to get 2 liters, 3 liters of water down a day? If so, let's back that off a little bit and see if there's any noticeable change in the frequency or intensity of the headaches, because it can play a role.
That is just so fascinating. And I think also kind of gives people permission to just listen to their bodies a little bit more, because we do force things based on the marketing, and usually marketing has got somebody who needs a bit of money behind it.
Yeah, in general.
In general. But it was quite interesting hearing you talk about cheese. I was like, no, don't take away my cheese.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, high tyramine. Well, so again, one of the things that I think we need to make sure people understand is that not all headaches are created equal, right? They're not all the same. And if you have headaches and you're trying to figure out what should I do about it, one of the first things to figure out is what type do I have, right? And we have, there's classification systems and you can take online tests and all these basic things. But in general, the two kind of major primary headaches we're talking about are migraine, and migraine has a lot of different versions. And then tension type headaches. Now, those are kind of classified. There's another version of headaches as well that most people, if they have these, are well aware, cluster headaches or trigeminal cephalgias, which are usually extremely intense. And those usually drive people to the doctor. But then after that, then we have secondary headaches, you know, headaches that are like a tension headache, but they're coming from the upper cervical spine, et cetera. So whenever we're talking about foods, high tyramine foods like red wine and cheese, which and chocolate and, you know, a few other things that people tend to love, those tend to be more closely associated with migraine presentations. Okay. It's just a kind of well-known issue. So in most cases, if people are getting information or directions about the classics, they'll be told try to avoid those foods. It doesn't always help, doesn't always work, doesn't always matter, because there's a lot of different reasons that you can have a migraine, but it is something that we try to make people aware of.
Yeah, that's really helpful. My cousin always used to get migraines from eating chocolate, and I used to really like feel so bad for her. I was like, oh, you poor thing. But it was so funny, like how pain works. Like, we've obviously had a chat on the show about pain. Please go and listen to that, everybody. It's very enlightening. But she was like, I don't care. I want this chocolate. Like, I'm going to suffer because I want to eat the chocolate. I found that quite interesting.
Hey, it's you're weird. An adult.
You can make these decisions. And listen, I'm so glad you touched upon the two types, because I actually have made some little sort of distinctions about migraine. And guys, I think this might be quite helpful. And Dr. Kopp, chip in whenever you want, because this is your words that I'm quoting. But migraines tend to be on one side, and they tend to be really instigated through sound sensitivity, right?
That is a, yeah. So whenever we talk about migraines, usually single-sided. And they can be associated with what's called aura. So prior to the pain setting in, you can have sound hypersensitivity, light sensitivity, tactile sensitivity, et cetera. There are also migraines without aura. So you don't necessarily have all these prodromal symptoms, but all of a sudden you start getting this unilateral throbbing pain. And then at that point, maybe you become very sound sensitive or photosensitive.
Okay, that's really interesting. Yeah. I think that the pulsating was another really important key factor, which differs to the tension headaches, where they tend to be sort of a pressing, tightening, mm-hmm. bilateral distribution.
Yep, that's correct. So you can have tension headaches that throb as well, but usually the first big differentiator is, do you get headaches on one side? Does it happen bilaterally? What's the location? Is it around your eye? Is it across your forehead? Is it your temples, the back of your head? And those kind of give us some basic starting points.
Okay. So, I mean, would you approach treating those two different presentations differently? I mean, obviously, yes. So I feel annoyed at myself for asking that, but like, if you have like something really obvious migraine, obviously, what's the first thing you would kind of do with someone who's presenting?
So the only way to actually answer this is to talk about the management process. So if someone's presenting with a migraine, meaning they have a migraine right now, what we'll start with is something to try to reduce the pain, right? I'll talk a little bit about the anatomy and maybe some targeted ideas. Sorry, I think I just bumped my desk. If I'm vibrating, it's because I just hit my desk. So before we get into that, I want to actually talk about the idea of rehab, right? So if someone has migraines and we're trying to take them through a rehabilitative process, the first thing you actually have to do is start tracking. you have to have a conversation with them and go, look, we need to use an app or a notebook or something. We need to know how many headaches and days you're having every month. We need to have an intensity, because the issue with human beings in general is that we may have pain, but depending on how our brains work, we may over-exaggerate it. We may forget about it.
Yeah.
So if you don't have records and you don't have reliable data, it's going to be difficult to know if you're making progress. Because when you're trying to deal with headaches of any kind or any pain that is intermittent in nature, if you don't have data, you're guessing. And that is very frustrating for the coach. It's frustrating for the client. So it starts there, actually. And I'm pretty adamant with people. Like, you know, don't, I know you can tell me I get a few a month. That's not super helpful. Like, I want to know how many to the day. I want to know what hours of the day, because that may give us information. If it's a female client, where is it in relationship to the menstrual cycle? Because that can actually play a very large role. So if you are going to go through this process with someone, it all starts with data collection. And you have to explain to them, you know, it's going to be a month or two of, we're going to give you stuff to do, but we have to get an idea of where we're starting. So that would be number one. When you then start dealing with migraine, I think it's super helpful to have a little bit of information about anatomy. So there's still a lot of debate on what drives migraines, why we get them, et cetera, but we do have some pretty well-established ideas at this point. So the first thing that we generally have people, well, again, I'm talking to people as coaches now, not as a necessarily a migraine sufferer, because you might not care until we get to the punchline, which is what to do about it. But in general, whenever we look at migraines, we're going to be interested in what's called the trigeminal nerve. All right. The trigeminal nerve is, it's cranial nerve 5. It's this big, enormous nerve that does all kind of stuff in the face, head and neck, and also around the brain. So in general, when people have head pain, it involves a loop or a connection between the trigeminal nerve and then a couple parts of the brain called the thalamus and the cortex. So this is kind of the main transmission nerve that we're going to be super concerned about anytime someone has migraine. So if you then think about that and go, okay, well, if the trigeminal nerve is maybe a problem, we need to know what it does. The first thing it does is it gives us sensory information from the skin. There's three different divisions of that nerve. There's for the forehead, underneath the eyes, and along the jaw. It also provides sensation from areas of the eye, the sinuses, inside the mouth, on the tongue. So there are a lot of different things that this nerve does. It also is in charge of muscle activity for what we call our muscles of mastication, so muscles for chewing. So whenever we bite down, we can feel these muscles pop out here and then up around the temple. Temporalis and masseters, the trigeminal nerve is in charge of how hard they contract. So if you then follow that nerve into the brain, it's going to send information to kind of three key areas. All right. And this is, I'm going to talk about kind of the stem. It's called the brain stem. So we have the big brain sitting on this little trunk, and that little trunk has three different divisions. And the trigeminal nerve sends information to nuclei in each of the divisions. So we have one on top, that's called the mesencephalon or midbrain. We have one in the middle, that's called the pons. And then we have one at the bottom called the medulla. So here's kind of how this works. If we look at the information that's going into the top of the brainstem, the mesencephalon, from the trigeminal nerve, it's getting information about where my jaw is in space. Okay, how's my jaw moving? It's also getting information from my teeth. So when I bite down, how are my teeth hitting? You know, as I'm chewing food, can I chew food without biting through my lip, biting through my tongue? Your brain has to be aware of where your jaw is and how it's moving. And interestingly enough, that area also gets information about eye muscles. So, you know, part of what you're doing with Dan and putting a patch on and making his eyes move differently, you were influencing that part of his brainstem. The next part, that middle part, the pons, is going to be getting the sensory information. So if you stroke your forehead, you rub your eyes, right? You put saline in your nose, right? Any of those things are going to give sensation. Those are going to be processed in that middle arena, as well as we're also going to be sending the signals to make the muscles contract in our jaw out of that middle area. And then we go to the bottom. And this is called the spinal trigeminal nucleus. And this one's really important in migraine and all headaches, because it's this part, this bottom part, that processes threat information. So what we would call nociception from anywhere. And interestingly enough, it is most responsive to nociceptive input coming from the what's called the ophthalmic division of the trigeminal nerve. So basically around the eyes and the forehead. So basically our brain is more sensitive to pain signals, or what could potentially become pain signals, from this area. So whenever we say, all right, how do I use any of that information to deal with a migraine? Well, what would that tell us? Well, it would tell us that doing some exercises that would help us improve our understanding of where our jaw is in space would be potentially helpful. It tells us that maybe we need to have our teeth evaluated, because if I have a low-grade tooth infection or I'm biting weird and I'm getting some odd contacts, or I've had some prior surgery done and I have a root, you know, I had a root canal and I've got some weird scar tissue buildup that I'm unaware of because it's not hurting. That could all point to, we need to look at the top. I could then also look at your eyes and say, hey, do your eyes move normally? If not, that's again going to all impact on that area of the brainstem. Interestingly enough, that area, that top area of the brainstem also plays a role in processing sound. So this is one of the reasons that we probably have this hyperactive response when we have a migraine. Then it would also tell me that maybe I could use sensory stimulation to influence that middle part. So what you'll see us using a lot in dealing with headaches is we'll use vibratory tools around the forehead, around near the eyes. We might use different variations of heat and cool around the face. We may combine those together where we're using vibration and hot and cold all at the same time. We can also go through sensory retraining where we take a Q-tip or a piece of cotton. We have you close your eyes. We stroke here, and we ask you, does that feel the same? And very often what you'll find in people with migraine is that they'll say, oof, no, that side is really sensitive. And so we will start trying to do some type of sensory retraining to make you understand, nope, it's supposed to feel like this. And there's some different ways to do that. And then from there, as we start to kind of work our way further down, we know, as I said, that this area responds a lot to the subthalamic division. So that's going to tell us that in addition to the jaw work, the tooth work, the sensory work, we're probably going to concentrate a lot of our sensory efforts in this division initially.
Which is the eyebrows and just below the eye socket, just in case people are listening and not seeing you.
Because that may actually give us the greatest amount of kind of blockade of signals going into that that trigeminal nucleus there. So I know it's a lot of information, but those are kind of different approaches that we would probably start with, in addition to using things to just downregulate threat overall, like breathing, maybe a little bit of eye massage, assuming they don't have glaucoma or some kind of other comorbidity.
So yes, it is a lot of information. And one of the things that I keep saying over and over is that when you start learning about neurology, it's simultaneously extraordinarily frustrating, but also empowering, because frustrating in the sense that there's so many variables, but at last we are actually looking at the body holistically. So it's quite cool to hear you talk about things like the trigeminal nerve, how that feeds into the brainstem. And another part that I was hoping you would touch upon, well, two things actually. One is the meninges, because I find that fascinating, that your brain can't actually feel pain. Well, sorry, the pain is an output. Let me correct myself. But meninges has the nociception. Yeah, the meninges has got all the nociceptors, which I'm just like mind blowing, I think. Yeah. And then also the greater occipital nerve is really interesting. Can you please expand on those two structures? Thanks for listening. That was part one of the show. Next week, I'll be releasing part two. Remember, if this episode was helpful at all, please do share, rate, and review.